This is the Gary V Audio Experience.
It's Donda Russo. My question is, I wanted to know your thoughts on people using video to ask questions, and do you think that they will pay for it to ask questions and have them answered by an expert? Love your answers. Thanks. Bye.
Dawn, this is a tremendous question with a very important answer. I think that people will pay for anything. Let me say that again. People will pay for anything if they perceive it has value. If there was an Ask Gary Vee show in 1967, and I'd be like, hey, groovy cats, it's the Ask Gary Vee show. You know, really excited. Oh, Dawn, you're thinking like, will people pay for water? That's totally far out. That's no way. Like, that would be the wrong answer. What happened was Poland Springs, and I'm sure plenty of people long before Poland Springs, I'm just not educated on the early days of the water industry, people came along and convinced people that bottled water had value. I mean, you go ask your grandparents. Here's a little fun weekend challenge. Go ask your grandparents what they first thought, if they can remember, not because they're old, just like if they can remember, what they thought about the idea of people paying for water. Think about how you feel. Steve, how do you feel on the notion that, I mean, I don't know if you know this, but you have at certain times paid $3 to $4 for a bottled water at an airport or some scenario, you absolutely have done it. What do you think about that?
I paid $3 for a water in Central Park the other day.
And?
I was really unhappy about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a absolute brain twist. People will pay for answers, even though so many people are watching right now. You have a free show here that you don't pay for answers from somebody very qualified, thank you very much. But I do think people will pay. Now, are you good enough? Have you built up enough brand equity? And have you created the perception of the value to your answers to have that be the case for you? And more importantly, how many unicorns are there to be able to do that? How many people have built up enough historical execution and have charisma and ability to answer? How many Jack Welch's, how many Mark Zuckerberg's? And then more importantly, the people that have actually pulled it off have to be in a very interesting part of their career or enjoy it. I love Q&A so much that I have to do this show for me, for happiness, not for the ROI on the time. I'm sure it's building audience. There's a lot of good variables. Sure, there'll be a right hook with the Ask Gary Vee book. But the truth is, the amount of money I'm gonna make on the book is shorter than if I did 6 speeches. So, you know, it doesn't make sense mathematically. And so a lot of people that would be good enough to pull off having people answer for them would never wanna do that as a business. Like, you know, so I think it's an interesting challenge. What I would say is there's probably uniquely 100 to 10,000 people that look the part, similar to be very honest, with as much humility as I can possibly say this, similar to me that can probably pull it off to a meaningful scale. My intuition is there's a lot of people that can get 8 people to pay to answer their question, but that's not real.
Lyndon wants to know, what kind of headlines attract you on social media?
Lyndon, this is a great question. I think the interesting part about this question is I think a lot of different headlines attract me, and I think the headline copy reading called the BuzzFeedification of media is fully in play now. I mean, when you go look with a cynical, it'd be fun to ask Steve this question. It probably hurts your, that's not true. I'm curious what your take is on the fact that like the New York Times now does this, right? Like literally the whole world has gone slang and 5, you know, ways to do this. Like it's all headline copy marketing. It's the stuff I built Wine Library on email marketing headlines. It's just become the game. I'm not quite sure exactly what's grabbing my attention. Usually it's around the subject matter. So usually things that scare me, like Jets running backs in trouble. Oh no, you know, like, so, I'm not sure, but the reason I wanted to answer the question is because I think it's very important for everybody who's watching the show. I know a lot of people here are go-getters, entrepreneurs, and do-gooders, whether you're trying to raise money for your charity or whether you're trying to sell a boot for the winter, you need to really think about the copy on everything you put out. It is an absolute variable to success. You can follow all the structural advice that I'm giving you, but when you get to writing the copy on a Facebook dark post or a Pinterest post or on Twitter, if you're not good at that, if you're not good at grabbing someone's attention, you're in big trouble. And so
I'm not sure what's grabbing my attention, but I know that the person behind writing it is doing a good job.
The Maple Parlor asks, what's your best piece of advice for a first-generation American entrepreneur venturing out on her own, away from her family business?
April, first and foremost, India just shared some other photos from your Instagram besides your question, and your product looks delicious. I think the biggest thing that I tell everybody is, number one, practicality. How much money do you have to stay alive for how long? That is always my biggest fear. First-time entrepreneurs make this mistake. Do you have 1 year's worth of rent and overhead? And then you have to make your actions respond to your bleeding of cash before you turn a profit. When you start a new business, especially an ice cream parlor, you know, a restaurant, kind of, you know, what you're doing, you've got to make sure that, you know, you're putting up upfront investment financially, not just time. It's not like you're building something with code. You're literally, you know, paying rent and buying supplies. And so you need to have a high level of practicality. The other thing that I tell entrepreneurs that are more practical, again, physical location, you know, it sounds like the way you asked the question, that you're leaving your own family's business and doing your own thing. You know, hopefully it's not competing directly with your own family's business, so there's not some weirdness. I think the thing that you really need to pay attention to is you have made a decision that does not allow you in year one any time to do anything but build your business. You are not allowed, you're almost not even allowed to watch the Ask Gary Vee show going forward. Like, you are in such a code red zone that every minute, call it 18 hours a day out of 24, if you want this to be successful, need to be allocated for your business, you know, even at the mercy in year one of your family time. Even at the mercy of that. And so I guess what I'm getting at, and you could tell by my tone and vibe on this question, is I'm scared, and I think one of the biggest reasons so many people go out of business in the first year, first 2 years, small business, practical, where they're burning cash, is they don't realize how hard it is and how all in you have to be. And so if you really want this dream to come true, you've got to make substantial sacrifices.
John asked, what are your thoughts on creating a successful long-term social media strategy for yourself or your clients? How long in advance do you create the content you roll out?
John, this is a good question. I mean, I think this all comes down to something that I call reverse engineering. The truth is, everybody's different. Vision is very long-term. I don't know how you define long-term in your question, but some people think long-term is 3 to 5 years. I think long-term is until the day I die. And so my clients may not be as patient when you're a Fortune 500 company that needs to hit numbers each quarter. Your patience to build a 3 to 5 year plan is non-existent. When you're a Series C startup company that just raised $200 million and you're only burning $4 million, you've got a lot of patience, and the idea of building brand and having a patience game to your execution becomes more attractive. Then we reverse engineer that. Then it's more about branding, Instagram, doing high-end video, long-form content with no right hook, a lot of jabbing. If you're a startup that's gonna go out of business in 24 weeks, if you don't sell some stuff, we're in full right hook, you know, Facebook dark post, SEO, SEM, influencer marketing with calls to action to sell. All that stuff completely is determined based on the client's current short-term and long-term needs. But the truth is, short-term and long-term needs really balance based on a moment in time. And so, the reason I think I'm good at business is, for all of my talking, I am 10x at my listening skills. And it all just comes down to listening. So the way we strategize is predicated on listening. And I think the biggest challenge for so many of the VaynerNation that's watching right now is, I don't think a lot of you, and this is with all due respect, this is for everybody, I'm just picking on you because I love you, tough love. I think a lot of people aren't really sure what they want to accomplish in a 1 year window versus a 5 year window versus a 10 year window. And their behavior doesn't map to it. To me, I got lucky. I just decided it's, everybody shows up to my funeral, hedge forever, build up equity, cash it in as I need it, if I ever need it, which has allowed me to be very patient
and really has allowed me to dictate my behavior of being probably a better human being. And in a weird way, and again, I think a lot of people would find this funny, in a lot of ways I've been a pushover as a entrepreneur, because if you would look at it in the short term, I'm leaving money on the table, I'm not fighting for every cent, I'm not trying to drill it down to the biggest advantage, I'm not even getting mine every time because I'm just hedging along the way. And so it just comes down to what you're trying to accomplish. I think the better question to this question is, how can you help someone, or are you capable of really understanding what you're trying to accomplish?
Hey Gary, Sean Bruce here. We've had opportunities to talk before. I do the sales and marketing for the Langston Hummus Company. My question today is, what was the biggest decision you made in your life that made you as successful as you are today? I've watched a lot of your keynotes, I've watched a lot of your different rants and waves and everything and interviews, but I want to know, what is your honest opinion of the biggest thing that you did that made you as successful as you are today? Thanks, Gary, and I look forward to your answer.
Thanks, brother. You know, I'm glad you asked this question, because I now can really, like, I was going there in my mind. I know what the answer is. It's a weird answer, actually. I think the biggest decision I ever made was in fourth grade when I got an F on a science test in Mr. Molnar's class. And I decided literally after, you know, first I had to get it signed by my mom. I don't know if they still do that and you get bad grades. Like, this was some 80s stuff, but they do in India. I had to get it signed, and I was not interested in being punished, so I didn't bring it to her, and then I put it in under my bed, and then it sat there for 2 days, but then I was still young, my conscience still had too much power, and I got scared and told my mom about it. By the way, 3 years later, I was flushing every report card directly down the toilet. You can evolve quickly. When you make the mental decision that I made, no joke, I literally remember sitting in my room and having a weird kind of crying, debating moment in fourth grade in my small bedroom, deciding, screw school, I'm a businessman, and I'm gonna eat the pain of being punished every 4 times a year during the school year, being viewed upon as a loser or a kid that doesn't have a shot by all of society, because I see something different, I have enough self-awareness of who I am, I'm gonna win. And literally, this is weird, I'm a fourth grader, you know, how old are you in fourth grade? My daughter's 5, I'm 9, 10, 11, 10, you know, and I'm literally deciding that I'm willing to eat it for the next 8 years, maybe even 12 years of my life, where that was just a hardcore decision. And it's not that I didn't care, I went to every class, I just decided to hone in on my skills, that I would learn more about selling baseball cards, that later at 14 became, I would learn more about selling wine, I honed in, and so, it was the first time, my man, that I made a decision that I was gonna fight society's optics and deliver on what I thought I was, and that's what I did.
Johannes asks, how do you balance speed, hustle, and patience?
This is the best question, because the truth is, I really believe that I'm a bridge, right? I'm pulling equally very aggressively from both sides, that I'm a human contradiction, that if you really watch the show and it throws people off as they get deeper into my content, that oftentimes I'm saying things that contradict themselves, because the truth is they both live in real life at the same time, and it's about finding that cadence and balance to guide through. I am massively, at a global level, patient, but on a practical level and an execution level, I'm very fast. Right? So it really is religion and church, right? Like at the highest, like at the theoretical, at the gray levels, I'm patient, long game. I'm aware that as long as I'm alive, I'm playing the businessman game, and it doesn't end tomorrow, and if it ends tomorrow, I don't know the outcome anyway, because I'm dead, right? And so, but in real life, I understand it's a race, and the speed is a variable for success to me in a big way, hustle, and so the patience and speed are very much rubbing against each other, but it's like the diamond comes from that, right? And so that's the thing that I think about. I find it very easy to do both. You have to understand, there's people that are both in practical and philosophical terms, and they have different outcomes. AKA, there's people that philosophically are not patient, they're impatient, and they're fast. And they look like the bad version of what I am,
right? They're like hustlers, and they're like doing everything for themselves, and they're not patient. They don't care about the long game, and they're just gonna take, and they're just gonna take and take and take, and they're gonna take fast, and they're gonna gather, and I think that society, the game rewards them, and there's a lot of millionaires and billionaires that didn't do it the right way, and that's what I think they look like. Then there's a lot of people that are massively patient and slow, and those are the enormous amount of people that, you know, in a business context, not in life, they're probably some of the loveliest human beings that have ever been made because they're slow and they're patient and everything's just lovely and let's just like sit on the porch and, you know, drink peach tea for the rest of our lives and like go slow, just go real slow, like let's sit and look at stuff, like let's sit on the porch and look at stuff, like a car just drove by. Great. Like, I mean, like that, you know, is not interesting to me either. And so that exists. So I actually think what I do exists a lot. I think it's the likable, you know, aggressive person. And that's, you know, they're out there. And there's a lot of winners that are good people. I really think that. And I think if you look at my analogies, the speed part is really valuable, right? Like if you're speedy and selfish and impatient, you know, I think the other thing about the lack of patience and fast, you don't have to be a bad person. I think it leads to mistakes, right? That's another variable layer here. You know, it's funny that my brain went that first narrative. Here's a second narrative. You're going fast, you're not patient, so you rush the outcome and you leave money on the table. You sold the company too soon. You weren't as profitable as you could have been because you missed things because you didn't see it because you weren't tactful. You know, I think it has essence of strategy. You know, somebody once said to me about Vayner, Gary, you guys are so interesting. He was trying to zing me a little bit that we weren't strategic enough. He said, you're so interesting, but he's like, when you get into the house, I feel like a lot of times you guys just run through the glass window instead of opening the door. Like, it was a funny analogy. And then I looked at him and said, yeah, but we're gonna own all the homes.
Kyle asks, when you are hustling, how do you spot the difference between busy work and valuable work?
You know, Kyle, that's a great question, and honestly, that's a work in progress always. This is something I've dealt with my whole life. Like, you know, I don't think I've mastered it. I don't think that I mean, I'm doing busy work even now at the level that I'm at. I'm still doing busy work that I think is, in hindsight, not as good. I think experience helps you. I think over time, I've learned through, oh crap, I remember when I did that back in the day, don't do that again. You start understanding. But I think one of the biggest mistakes that entrepreneurs make, especially as they grow their business, or in the beginning when they're crippled by this thought of quality work versus just doing it, you know, like smart work versus just work, is when you start judging it too much, you start leaving yourself out of opportunity for serendipity and upside that you can't see. There's been a lot of things that on paper may look like busy work, going to get, you know, just kissing babies and shaking hands, or just replying to everybody on Twitter, things that not everybody thinks is the best scalable use of my time that has led to enormous upside because it wasn't obvious when you first did it, including a video show, including 10 years ago in a month, sitting upstairs doing a video show where everybody's like, we needed you that hour to sell wine or to reorganize our operations. Why are you putting a video on YouTube? What is YouTube? Like, got it? It ended up being the biggest, single biggest decision of my career up to this point, transitioning myself into a media property and a brand from just being an operator on this floor. Wasn't obvious, felt like it could have been busy work. And there's been other things that I've done like that that have been busy work. You know, I'm trying to think of a good example, but like a million things that we've stopped and started that didn't become real. It happens with us every day in our team. So I think that, I think you don't always know. I think you find out after the fact. And I think to have a long 40 to 60 year old professional career that's successful, as long as you're learning in year 1, 3, 7, 9, 12 patterns, start becoming more self-aware about yourself, understanding your strengths and weaknesses, you start having less just busy work and more high impact work, and that's what's happened in my career.
This is the Gary V Audio Experience.